Welcome back to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle while he takes a couple days off. Well, social media does not stay sanitary on its own. There are tens of thousands of real people who work around the clock to moderate major sites, removing pornographic or violent images that violate terms of service agreements. My next guest has written a book on social media moderators, the people who keep the internet clean, for lack of a better term. And what she found is pretty interesting and pretty disturbing when it comes to the working conditions that some moderators face. It also raised broader questions about mental health consequences of this growing number of people who are employed to watch and scrub social media platforms. Joining me in studio is Sarah Roberts, author of Behind the Screen, Content Moderation in the Shadows of Social Media. That is published today from Yale University Press. She's an assistant professor of information studies at UCLA and co-director of the UCLA Center for Critical Internet Inquiry. Sarah, thank you very much for being in studio.
Thanks so much for having me.
So can you just describe what a social media moderator does? What is that job in a nutshell?
Simply put, these are human beings for whom the work of reviewing and deciding upon user-generated content online is their professional job. They sit essentially in front of screens, typically for an eight-hour shift per day, and they receive the material that maybe users like you or me would have witnessed online and had a problem with, maybe flagged as abusive or problematic, gory, disturbing, pornographic, etc. And that material is then essentially routed to these folks in queues, one after the other, moment by moment. And they take a look at this material and they weigh it against the rules of the given platform for which they moderate and make a decision about its appropriateness. And it's sort of a never-ending flood of this material when we think about the scale and scope of social media.
I want to dig into what that job is like and its implications. I do want to throw this out there. If we do have any social media moderators on Facebook, Twitter, any of the sites that require moderation, current or former, if you've experienced this work before, I'd love to take your call, 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. You can also go on our AirTalk page on kpcc.org on social media if you would like to communicate that way, if you're not too sick of it. Sarah Roberts in studio with me. This must have a lot of decision-making involved. I want to get to the imagery in just a second, but this is a human making decisions about what is allowed to be going in front of other humans, right? I mean, there's a lot of First Amendment right issues, I'm assuming.
Well, there are and there aren't, in the sense that social media companies that may emanate from the United States are actually global concerns. And if we think about a platform like Facebook as just one example, I think the last statistic says something like 87% of their user base comes from outside the United States. So whether or not the First Amendment would be applicable, relevant. First of all, Facebook's a private company. It's not the public square. And secondly, most of the user base comes from outside the United States. So our own norms and associations with ability to express ourselves in the context of the United States isn't always one that would be globally applied, and it certainly wouldn't be in the context of a private company that's offering its platform as a service.
So you described this job 8 hours a day, working to watch for images that people have flagged that may be inappropriate for social media platforms. What type of imagery are moderators exposed to on a daily basis?
The best way to get a sense for what these folks are seeing is for anyone who's a user of any of these major platforms to seek out the community standards information about the platform, which is usually user-facing and publicly available. And it will tell you the kinds of things that are prohibited on that platform. Those tend to be for the mainstream sites, things like gratuitous violence, abusive speech or hate speech. It might be violence towards children. It might be sexual material. Even war zone footage, when it's uploaded for advocacy purposes, might not meet the threshold of being kept up due to due to gore. So there's actually quite a gamut of material that people are, for whatever reason, compelled to upload and want to share that really the platforms deem inappropriate as a function of brand protection and brand management for their user base and for significantly for the advertisers that advertise on their platforms.
So this must be some disturbing stuff oftentimes. I mean, things that people are exposed to all day long because that's their job. Looking at violent images, at sexual content that it can't be shared. What's the effect on these workers? You've spoken to some of them for your book. What are they dealing with?
Surprisingly, the job sort of has two poles. On the one hand, it can be monotonous to the point of being mind-numbing or boring. There are a lot of false positives. People might report things for unknown reasons. You know, you get a lot of cute cat pictures in there or wedding photos or things that really aren't bad. But then what happens in many cases is those moments of kind of rote boredom get punctuated by shocking material. And sometimes it's that juxtaposition that's the hardest for folks to deal with. People who are doing this work might be predisposed to having trouble with certain types of imagery rather than others. So when I talk to some of the workers, some of them would express particular difficulty around certain types of imagery. I remember in one case, a worker even told me it wasn't necessarily the things he saw, but it was the audio that he heard. And he said, you know, the one thing I can't stand is any audio of someone screaming or crying in pain. But unfortunately, because of the work he did, he heard a lot of that.
He would have to listen and be decide whether or not it was going to stay up or not. I'm talking with Sarah Roberts. Behind the Screen, Content Moderation in the Shadows of Social Media is her book. She is an assistant professor at UCLA and co-director of the UCLA Center for Critical Internet Inquiry. We're discussing this growing field of content moderation on social media and its effects on workers and the ways that social media platforms are working to address workplace conditions for people who have to keep our internet platforms free of pornography, violence, things like that. We're going to be back after a really quick break. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle today. And if you are somebody who has worked as a moderator before, you can share your story at 866-893-5722. We're going to be back after this break with Hedy Lyn Hurdies. Air Talk on KPCC, Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. We're talking about the work of content moderation on social media. It's a growing field because somebody has to look at all the disturbing content that's been flagged as violating terms of service agreements and then decide whether or not that content gets pulled down from Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and other platforms. Sarah Roberts is with me, author of Behind the Screen, Content Moderation in the Shadows of Social Media. And she's also a professor at UCLA. Sarah, what's the scope of this workforce? How many people are employed in this work worldwide?
Great question. Up until recently, those numbers have been really hard to come by. And the reason is that the firms that need the content moderation have largely been very secretive about these practices. In the past year, year and a half or so, the bigger firms have been coming out publicly about the fact that they employ these workforces, and they've been giving us some numbers. If we look at firms like Facebook, Google, and its multiple properties, and so on, we're already into the multiple tens of thousands just with those couple companies alone. Obviously, those are the biggest players in the market. But when we think about the Snaps, the Kicks, the smaller but still very important social media properties where people are exchanging information, videos, and photos.
TikTok, things that I'm too old to understand.
You got it. Things we'll find out about after the fact. All of those, basically anywhere user-generated content can be uploaded to a platform that is a privately held company, there's a need for moderation. And so when we start calculating just raw numbers about what that would look like, we're up to probably the six figures. And, you know, I try to keep my estimates conservative, but this is a huge workforce. The other piece of that, too, is that it's a workforce that tends to be a revolving door. So it's not like people come into this work and stay in it for decades. They come in, they might do it for a few years and then revolve out, which means more and more people are involved beyond just those raw numbers of where it might be at a moment in time.
because it's not a highly skilled position per se. It's something you can kind of plunk a person in a seat in order to do, but it is highly demanding in a mental health capacity because you're looking at so much disturbing content every day. You traveled to the Philippines, I understand, to do research for your book. What did you discover there? Who did you talk to, and what did you find?
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that assessment. The work is a globalized practice, and so you will find it around the world. And the reason for that is to meet the company's needs for cultural and linguistic specificity, but also for the simple fact that large labor pools and infrastructure are needed for this work to be done. One of the places in the world that is uniquely set up to serve those needs is the Philippines, and particularly in relation to the North American market. So Filipino people have a long-standing relationship of being under colonial dominance from the United States. And for that reason and for other reasons, many people in that country have good command of the English language. And the country itself has also oriented itself in the market to be basically the call center of North America. And so not only are people answering calls, service calls for Sears or whatever in the Philippines, but more and more they're moving to this kind of non-phone call digital labor. Because of this infrastructure and because of the labor pool availability. So I traveled there and I spoke with workers who were working in the Philippines. One of the things I found was that, in fact, they were not so different from their North American counterparts. They tended to be young people. They were urbanites. They were upwardly mobile. They were looking for jobs in the tech industry, which had been sort of suggested to them as the way up and out of a difficult economic existence. Most of them were college grads, and they had a lot of aspirations. And not one of them had ever seen themselves being in this role as a professional content moderator prior to taking the job.
I mean, there's issues with PTSD, all the mental health effects that can come from watching violent and listening to violent things all day long on a social media platform like these moderators do. What are the companies doing to address the effects on their workers? I know that it's a largely contract position and it's a revolving door, as you mentioned. Are the companies addressing the fact that these are still human beings that are forced to be the filter for very disturbing stuff online?
I've been looking at this industry and this phenomenon for just about a decade. And in that time, I am pleased to report that there has been some improvement in this issue of mental health support for workers. But it's certainly nowhere near what our expectation might be. The larger companies such as Facebook and others have more and more come under the gun in terms of how they are handling this issue for their workers. And recently, Facebook made a very significant announcement about doing things like raising minimum wage and providing other support for their contract content moderators in the United States. For me, that, of course, brought up the issue of, okay, if that's the case for Facebook, what are the other companies doing or not doing in terms of mental health support? We might expect that be provided in the United States context, but what about places in the world where there's a significant cultural taboo around seeking mental health support? I mean, that exists here as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when your success as a content moderator is predicated on your ability to stomach or deal with this kind of material, kind of standing up in the middle of your workday and saying, I'm going to go meet with the therapist who's on site today, a lot of the workers expressed to me they'd just rather not do that. They'd rather just sort of take it on themselves, or they'd tell me, yeah, I can handle this, and then demonstrate in other ways that really they couldn't.
I just think about, yeah, the ways the internet is presenting all of these mental health challenges that we never foresaw. Both users of social media, the way that Instagram and Facebook and all the glossy social media platforms affect our mental health and stress levels, but then this entire workforce that you wrote about, moderators that are also carrying this burden of being the filtration system. Sarah Roberts is the author of Behind the Screen, Content Moderation in the Shadows of Social Media. I recommend checking out the book if you're interested in this whole area of our modern economy that you may not have considered as you sit down to log into your Facebook page or your Twitter account. Professor Roberts, thanks so much for being here on Air Talk.
Thanks. It's been my pleasure. I appreciate it.
Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle today. Coming up next, how did you pay for your wedding? And more couples are taking out personal loans to pay for theirs. Is it a good idea? Spoiler alert, it might not be. We'll take your calls coming up on Air Talk here on KPCC.